this next speaker, she's the executive director of the National Center for Science Education and the author of Evolution versus Creationism. Please give a warm welcome to Eugenie Scott.
Good evening. It's very nice to be here. Now, the National Center for Science Education, where I work, is a nonprofit. It was founded by scientists and teachers in the early 1980s. We've been around a long time, and so has the creationism problem, unfortunately. A movement called creation science was claiming that a biblical literalist view of creation could be supported by science, and thus should be taught alongside evolution in science classes. Well, scientists and teachers and civil libertarians and a whole lot of other folks did not want to see this happen, and they united to defeat the proposed laws that would require equal time for creation science. And NCSC has continued to support teachers, museums, zoos, science centers, and even National Park Service personnel who face opposition to the teaching of evolution. And recently, we find that teachers are similarly having problems with the teaching of climate change. A few years ago, we began to notice that in legislation being submitted around the country, evolution was being bundled with global warming as topics that teachers should teach differently than other subjects in the curriculum. This got us interested in looking at the teaching of global warming, climate change, and we found many parallels to our concerns with the teaching of evolution and stop reading the newspaper article. That's what you're doing, aren't you? No. This is a prop, okay? The whole reason for showing this slide is just the headline, right? Darwin foes add global warming to the target list. That's what I'm trying to tell. And all of you people, because you're smart and you're well-educated, you're trying to read the damn article. No, just listen to me, all right? Just listen to me. This is a different kind of talk than you sometimes get in PowerPoint. Oh, please don't stop me on my PowerPoint rant. I apologize. I'm verging closely into getting into my PowerPoint rant, which you probably don't want to hear, but you don't put the talk on the slide. You're here to hear the speaker, and the slide is an illustration, okay? You don't put your notes on the slide, boys and girls, next time you do PowerPoint. Here we go. All right, so we got interested in looking at the similarities between anti-evolution and anti-global warming, so to speak. And eventually, this resulted in NCSE adding global warming to evolution as topics that we try to help teachers and members of science-friendly communities, shall we say, teach. So let me talk a little bit, very briefly, because we just had a wonderful lecture on evolution, and I don't have to talk about evolution, except in one context, because what we heard about just in the last talk was biological evolution, and that is a very, very important topic and near and dear to my heart as a, you know, physical anthropologist. That's what we do. But I think a lot of people don't realize that evolution is a much broader concept than just living things shared common ancestry. I mean, the big idea of evolution is that the whole blooming universe has changed cumulatively over time, which is why astronomy is an evolutionary science, because galaxies and the cosmology, if you will, of our universe has experienced a cumulative change. The past is different from the present. The future is going to be different from the present. And so there has been this cumulative change in the universe. The universe did not just come about at one time in its present form, which of course is the contention of the creationists and of some other religious views as well. What we know from science is that there has been this gradual cumulative change of the universe over time. Astronomy is an evolutionary science. Geology is an evolutionary science. We just had a wonderful summary of why biology is an evolutionary science. And anthropology also is an evolutionary science because human cultures have cumulatively changed over time. We had a lovely lecture about evidence for biological evolution, and I'm so glad that he talked about biogeography, which is a topic that most people don't understand and don't appreciate what a powerful source of evidence for evolution this is, and how persuasive it was to Darwin when he was on his voyage of the Beagle around the planet and was able to see the distribution of plants and animals, and the only way that distribution made sense is if living things shared common ancestors. And that is the wonderful power of evolution. Comparative anatomy, molecular evidence, the fossil record, developmental biology, these are all independent, largely independent sources of information from which you make the inference, the only reasonable inference, is that living things had common ancestors, and that is what biological evolution is all about. Well, that the planet is getting warmer also has multiple sources of evidence. There are a number of direct measurements that we can take to show us that the planet is getting warmer. Land surface temperatures, ocean temperatures, the mass of ice sheets and glaciers, shifting plants and animal biomes, or the environments in which various plants and animals can survive. We can measure these kinds of phenomena directly, and we can tell from these data that there has been a very sharp uptick in the warming of our planet in the last approximately 250 years. There also are proxy data, as they call them. There also are sources of information that we can look at in the scientific realm that are not direct measurements, like, you know, we put a thermometer out on a mountain someplace, but they are a variety of sources that, when taken together, allow us to continue the inference that climate has changed in the past as well. And these are all sources of information that similarly indicate that the current very rapid rate of warming that we're experiencing today is anomalous and very unusual for the planet Earth. Sea level rise can be inferred, as well as directly measured by satellite measurements, but we can infer sea level changes in the past by looking at the changes of coastlines, for example. We can look at ice core climate reconstructions, in which the isotopes of the composition of the ice changed depending on what the temperature was like. Sometimes the inclusion of microscopic animals in the various ice cores. You all know a little bit about ice cores. You can take an ice core through a glacier, and because every year there's a certain amount of snow that falls upon the glacier and freezes, and then there's some melt, and then next year there's some more, ice actually forms layers, much like the cores that you can take out of the bottom of lakes and oceans. It's a very similar kind of thing. So there's seafloor cores, climate reconstructions as well, and tree rings are another source of proxy data, or data from which you can infer climate changes very, very far in the past. And when you do this, these are just data from land surface temperatures from a variety of different sources. The particular chart comes from the Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature Group from Berkeley, California. All of these show increases in temperature during the last 250 years, which is quite startling and quite more rapid in rate than we've experienced in virtually all cases for the last several thousands of years. Pardon me. The burning of fossil fuels, beginning with the Industrial Revolution, increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. And there's some basic physics involved here. We've known since the 1800s, interestingly enough, just about the same time that Darwin was coming up with evolution by natural selection, so was John Tyndall coming up with the idea that CO2 was a warming gas. These are two scientists that lived at about the same time and were active in the 1850s. But CO2 is a warming gas that tends to reduce the heat radiation from the sun from being radiated back into space. More of it comes in, and rather than radiating back into space at a normal rate, the presence of CO2, methane, and certain other warming gases in the atmosphere means that less of this radiation, less of this warmth, escapes back into space, and so the planet gradually becomes warmer. We would expect this from the basic physics. We would expect the planet to get warmer as the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere increased. And when we look at both direct measurements as well as proxy measurements, you can see that the proxy measurements would be the ones to the left there. The amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has increased substantially since the Industrial Revolution. You see the sharp spike there at the right-hand side of that slide. Now, those were land surface temperatures, but which is the little orange line down at the bottom there. The oceanic heating has been much more striking and much more significant, really. Climate scientists refer to sinks where heat is being stored. Well, the ocean is the biggest heat sink, and there is a tremendous amount of heat from this non-radiated heat that comes in from the sun that is being blocked by the CO2 and the other warming gases. There's a tremendous amount of this heat that is being absorbed by the ocean. Thank goodness, in a way. Although, of course, that is having problems with oceanic life. It's having problems with, it's causing problems for things like ocean acidification. But in one sense, it's keeping the atmosphere from being warmer, and so that's something of an advantage to us landforms. But all is not beer and Skittles on land either. If you look at the shifting biomes, the plant and animal environments in the Northern Hemisphere, you can see quite a change. This is the most recent planting guideline that was released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. This is a lovely thing that gardeners have memorized. I see nods from the people around the audience who are gardeners. We look very closely at this, so we know where out on coastal California we can plant certain things, and if you live in Alabama, there's certain things that aren't going to do quite as well in your environment. And so these are very, very useful charts, and they're updated at periodic intervals. The most recent update of the USDA planting guideline informs us that you can now grow magnolias in New York. That's shifting biomes. Now, it's important more than for just where you can grow ornamentals, because most of the world's food, most of the energy that human beings depend upon comes from plants. And serious changes in the ranges in which, for example, major food crops can grow can create quite a bit of difficulty for human survival and well-being. Similarly, the kind of insect and other pests and pathogens that can survive in these shifting biomes also is significant for ourselves as human beings as well as for the other creatures that we're living with. Warming of temperature in North America, for example, has meant that the kinds of beetles that prey upon deciduous trees are extending their ranges further north into Wisconsin and Minnesota, so that your mixed deciduous and conifer forests up there in the north are losing their deciduous trees because the beetles aren't being killed off in quite as large numbers as they used to be because it's not as cold up there. I was talking last summer in Wisconsin's one of my home states, by the way, a very, very long time ago, 1966. I was a student at UW, so I'm very old. But anyway, I grew up in Wisconsin and Minnesota, and last summer I was giving a talk in Minneapolis to an environmental education group. And I was absolutely stunned to hear that a big lake north of the Twin Cities, where I was very familiar, Lake Minnetonka, didn't freeze over last year. The climate's changing. These biomes are shifting. Now, to take one example of climate change in food production, Ghana is the world's largest exporter of cocoa, okay? The main ingredient of chocolate, in case you hadn't noticed that. The current ideal environments for growing cocoa are indicated in the labeled slide. Predictions for climate change by 2030 show that the cocoa crop, your chocolate, is going to be drastically affected. Now, if that's not going to get your attention, it's hard to imagine. There are similar charts, by the way, for things like wine. and other major food groups. So, you know, we do have to take climate change being serious. But seriously, I mean, you know, where the rice crop in Asia can be grown is going to be a whole lot more important than where we can get chocolate. But nonetheless, all right. Now, a point that I probably don't have to make in this audience is that these topics of evolution and climate change are not controversial in science. Although they are controversial, they may be controversial in the general public. The Pew Foundation conducted a survey of members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, the largest society of American scientists, general across the board, and there was a clear disconnect between scientists and the general public on evolution. They asked the question, humans and other living things have evolved over time, true or false. 97% of the scientists in this survey in 2009 said, yeah. Only 61% of the public said yes in this survey. Now, these are both numbers that are slightly higher than other people have gotten, vagaries of the draw and what. But the difference between them is what I'm trying to point out. As opposed to humans and other living things have existed in their present form since the beginning of time, only 2% of the AAAS scientists agreed with that, compared to 31% of the general public. Similarly, with global warming, a survey was conducted among geologists. They asked, is the mean global temperature increasing? The scientists agreed 90%. A survey done at around the same time of the general public, I think the survey was done in 2009, but I'd have to check, found only 61% of the general public agreeing. Now, what was kind of interesting is that among the 3,000 or so geologists who were surveyed in this study, when they took a subset of the geologists who were active climate researchers and you know, looked at their answers to this question versus that of the general geology population, instead of getting 90% agreement, they got 96% agreement among the scientists who are, in one sense, the most qualified to comment on this topic. They also asked a second question. Is the global warming anthropogenic? Is human activity significantly contributing to this warming? And again, the percentage of scientists versus the general public is quite striking. 82% of the scientists in the survey versus 58% of the general public. 2009, I did remember it correctly. Again, the subset of climate scientists who are active researchers, when they were asked this question, instead of 82%, it was 97%. Again, compared to the general public, which is much more agnostic on this issue. And similarly, with evolution and climate change, when we look at the data from the United States versus international comparisons, our citizens lag behind those of other nations in both acceptance of evolution and in accepting that global warming is occurring. On the left, the United States is just above Turkey, on the bottom there, in its acceptance of evolution. The blue is accept. The red is reject, the yellow is not sure, and there we are. We beat Turkey. Good for us. on the right, British data show 87% of the general public accepting global warming, as opposed to the planet not warming 7%. So clearly something is going on in the United States regarding these two sciences. Both are accepted by scientists in very high numbers. Both have lots of empirical support. And both of these sciences are rejected by substantial numbers of the American public, though not citizens of other countries. And why is a very interesting question that my colleagues of mine and I at NCSC have been thinking about for quite a while now. First of all, when we talk about global warming, there are a number of perspectives. Global warming is not this monolithic yes-no kind of field. Global warming rejection takes several forms. The strongest and obviously the least easy to defend is the idea that it is not getting warmer. You know, I have my fingers in my ear, I'm not listening. And there are people who believe that, but it's really hard to support that given the tremendous amount of value. I confess I was multitasking in the back of the room during earlier talks today, and I just came across an article that was released today in Science Magazine. These are global data on warming, and, you know, yet one more time, all of the data is very consistent with the conclusion that the temperature is spiking within the past, in this case, within the past 100 years. So the most, the strongest position is just flat out denial of the fact that it's getting warmer. A less stringent position, if you will, is this: well, yes, it's getting warmer, but it's not our fault. Sort of the rejection of the anthropogenic component of global warming. Or the third position is, yes, it's getting warmer, yes, it's our fault, but kiss your ass goodbye. We can only accommodate, you know, we can't do anything to prevent the disaster. Don't do anything to decrease the amount of CO2 that is being released. All we can do is just move people back from the shore, you know, because the oceans are getting hot. So you find people, you know, if somebody says, oh, global warming is a hoax, the first thing you might want to ask that person is where on this continuum that person lies, because you may be, if he's in the first class, there's not a lot you can say, but you know, you can at least have aspects of debate with the other two. Now, again, comparing evolution and global warming. At NCSC, we found it very useful to refer to what we call the pillars of creationism, which are the three arguments that into which you can pretty much put any creationist contention, whether it's a book or a video or a pamphlet or a letter to the editor or just a conversation in the supermarket checkout line, if you are so unfortunate. but these three categories, shall we say, of arguments are, we found you can pretty much put everything in there. The first one is that evolution is weak science. Evolution is a theory in crisis. Scientists are giving up on evolution. This will come as a great surprise to scientists, of course. The second argument is that evolution and religion are incompatible. You have to choose. You can either be a good guy, Christian creationist, or you're a bad guy, atheist evolutionist, which of course makes people like Ken Miller something somewhat anomalistic, because he is a practicing Catholic and as convinced by evolution as the two of us, and hopefully the rest of you as well. But you know, we fuss around with the data more than normal people. So you know, this dichotomous view though is very, very strong in the creationist literature. And the third argument is what we abbreviate as the fairness argument. That teachers should teach both meaning creation, their view of creation, and evolution, because it's only fair, it avoids dogma, and quite frequently, especially in the last 10 or 15 years or so, we've been doing this a long time, you also get the argument that it's a good critical thinking exercise for students to weigh the evidence on both sides. Nobody here but us critical thinkers. Well, my colleague Josh Rosenau noticed that global warming denial falls into three very similar pillars. You find attacks upon the science. Anthropogenic global warming, particularly anthropogenic global warming, is weak science. You also find the argument that anthropogenic global warming is an anti-capitalist or a liberal plot. It's also a socialist plot. It's anti-capitalism. It's basically a libertarian and a conservative small government kind of ideology that motivates this. And you find exactly the same fairness argument. The teacher should teach both standard climate science and global warming denialism or contrarianism, because it'll be such a good critical thinking exercise. The parallels are very, very clear. If we wanted to summarize the pillars of rejection applicable to both global warming and evolution, there's the science approach, the ideology approach, the ideology differing, remember, in creationism, the ideology is religious. In global warming, the ideology is economic and political. There's a tiny, tiny, tiny little slice of religious ideology that you find among some of the global warming people. It's a providential argument. God would never let anything bad happen to the planet. Therefore, you know, it's human hubris to think that we could do anything about this. But that's such a tiny percentage of the people who think global warming is a hoax, that it's almost inconsequential. The major drivers, the major ideological drivers of the anti-global warming view is libertarian economic ideology, the free market fundamentalism, if you will, and the idea of small government, political ideology, attacks on individual freedoms, and so forth and so on. And the cultural argument, which I mentioned, which is virtually identical between these two controversies. Both views, let students decide for themselves, it's good critical thinking, it's fair, etc. So how are the pillars of denial reflected? Well, the main reason, as I mentioned, for rejecting evolution is religious. Some Americans hold to a special kind of theology called special creationism, in which God specially creates people, animals, earth, galaxies, the universe, etc., in its present form, their present form. The most common form of special creationism is young earth creationism, where this creation event occurred relatively recently, only a few thousands of years ago. There's also old earth creationism, which is still a special creationism perspective. The most common kind of old earth creationism is a form of what they call progressive creationism, where God creates consecutively through time. So the universe is old, the planet's old, time is not a big deal, radioisotopic dating is fine, they don't have a problem with that, but biological evolution is unacceptable. God created the kinds, but he just created them consecutively or sequentially through time. Both of these are special creationist points of view. Intelligent design is a creationist point of view that overlaps these two. Some of the ID folks are young earthers, some of them are old earthers, more are old earthers actually. But the fundamental principle of intelligent design really is special creation. When you see something like the bacteriophagella motor, this wonderful little complicated motor that makes a flagella move through the liquid, that could only be produced by an intelligence. It could not be produced by natural forces. That's basically what intelligent design is. You see something that's really, really complex in nature or really, really improbable, the natural forces couldn't have produced it. It had to have been created by an intelligence. And obviously the intelligence is a supernatural intelligence. It really isn't time-traveling biochemists. So the intelligent design position is really just a form of special creationism with a whole lot more statistical hand-waving. But when you really boil it down to its essence, it isn't greatly different from the other two. It's just as agnostic on things like, did Grand Canyon get cut by Noah's flood? There's also, it wasn't. Let your heart rest. At peace on that one. Commercial time, NCSC takes a raft trip through Grand Canyon every summer. And we give you the two-model approach, as it were. We give you the creationist view and the evolutionist view, and you can make up your own mind, of course. Most people kind of have made up their mind beforehand, which is why it's a fun trip. But it really is quite fabulous. We really have a very good time. So if you've ever wanted to see Grand Canyon, be sure you check out NCSC's raft trip, because we have much more fun than the creationists do, or anybody else for all of that. Because we're evolution nerds, of course we're going to have more fun. So the ideological pillar that supports anti-evolutionism is special creationist theology. There's also other views, human exceptionalism. We are so special, we had to have been specially created, and I don't want to be related to an animal. I don't want to be related to a monkey. They throw poop at you at the zoo, and you know, monkeys are icky little creatures, and so there's a lot of that. But the ideological pillar that motivates anti-global warming really is not so much religious as it is political and economic. Joe Bast is the head of the Heartland Institute, which is a major anti-global warming, well, we're all anti-global warming in one sense, but you know what I mean. It's an organization that does not accept the idea of global warming and produces a lot of material to try to convince people of that. And Joe Bast is its director. And he wrote, "The reason the teaching of climate change is so controversial is because environmental activists, many of them coming from the liberal end of the political spectrum, are using the subject to advance their political agendas." So it's this is just all politics. The science is being distorted in terms of the ideological goal to increase big government, increase the federal government, and restrict your right as an individual to make decisions about what kind of light bulb you buy, for example. And if you follow the light bulb story, that was just so painful. It was really awful. A lot of times people, you know, really get confused about religious conservatism, political conservatism. Let me just try to diagram this out, just because I love Venn diagrams anyway. All right. Religious conservatives hold certain religious views. They hold that the Bible is inerrant. They think that a personal relationship with Jesus is necessary for salvation. They call themselves evangelicals, fundamentalists, charismatics. There are many terms. The term they like to use for themselves is conservative Christians, so that's the one I use. There also are political conservatives. Political conservatives have confidence in capitalism as an economic system. They have, in general, opposition to taxation. They believe in minimal government. They elevate individuality and personal liberty to a high state. This is also combined with the American myth of the potential for everyone to succeed based on their own efforts. These are two different things. Not all religious conservatives are political conservatives. Some of the most energetic workers for the poor and disadvantaged are evangelicals. Not all political conservatives are religious conservatives, obviously. The intersection of political and religious conservatism is the religious right. And this diagram is relevant to both of the controversies that I'm talking about today. If we are to overlay anti-evolutionism on this diagram, what we would find is that, yes, the religious right is reliably anti-evolutionist. But actually, not all religious conservatives are anti-evolutionists. We have some very powerful allies among evangelicals in promoting the acceptance of evolution. Similarly, not all political conservatives are anti-evolutionists. Many political conservatives readily accept evolution because they belong to denominations that are not biblically literalist. The reason for anti-evolutionism occurring among political conservatives is that they are also religious conservatives. This is that religious right overlap. With anti-evolutionism, we're picking up the political conservatives because they're also religious conservatives, rather than picking up political conservatives per se. Well, and if we take global warming contrarians and overlay that on the diagram, it's the same sort of thing. The religious right is reliably anti-global warming, okay? And most political conservatives are usually anti-global warming as well. But there's not necessarily a close association between religious conservatism and anti-global warming. There is a substantial group of green Christians who are environmentalists. Their theology is creation care, stewardship theology rather than dominion theology, and they are outside of the anti-global warming movement. So ideologically, global warming contrarians are politically conservative rather than religiously conservative per se. Where you're picking up religious conservatives as anti-global warming enthusiasts is because they're also politically conservative. So if you can kind of keep these diagrams in mind and how the different controversies can shift back and forth, I think that is more useful. Again, the primary motivation for those who object to global warming is political conservatism and economic conservatism. Okay, back to the pillars. In summary, we can describe these pillars as focusing on science, ideology, and culture. And let me make a few comments about the first, which is questioning the science. This is fundamental to a rejection of these of global warming, as illustrated by Oreskes and Conway in their very, very good book, Merchants of Doubt. Challenging the science was a deliberate technique used by the tobacco companies during the decades that public health organizations attempted to demonstrate that smoking caused cancer, addiction, heart disease, and other conditions. The tobacco companies claimed that the science is not yet settled on the issue, even well beyond the point where there was a strong scientific consensus that smoking was bad for your health. The belief of the tobacco companies was that as long as they could create doubt in the public's mind about whether or not the science was settled, the tobacco companies could avoid restrictions on their business, such as warning labels, ability to advertise, advertising to kids, and so forth. And of course, in the case of global warming and evolution, you are manufacturing a lack of doubt rather than reflecting one. Tobacco companies use this effect very effectively, and so have creationists and global warming deniers. The Discovery Institute, which promotes intelligent design, has its list of scientists doubting Darwin. And they have over 800 scientists on this list now. Anybody here ever heard about Project Steve? When the DI list of scientists doubting Darwin came out, we were annoyed. But it's dumb, you know? I mean, why would you think that having a list of scientists who think the world is round or the world is flat would make any difference? That's not how you do science. You don't do science by voting on it. Okay, all you scientists who really prefer Lamarckism to natural selection, raise your hands. Oh, hell yes, I'll raise my hand. It doesn't work, but I'll raise my hand. You know, I'd much rather have Lamarckism than natural selection. It's terrible. No, I mean, you don't vote on how the world works. You have to hammer out the explanations of nature using the scientific processes that we've developed. And just having a list of science, this is politics. This is rhetoric. This is dumb. Unfortunately, we were besieged. We got emails, we got phone calls, we got people stopping us, not exactly in the hallway because we're too little, but people came up to us and said, we've got to, NCSC has to organize a petition. We have to hammer these people into the ground. This is so stupid. They got 200 scientists or 100 scientists originally doubting Darwin. We can get tens of thousands of scientists. And we said, no, this is a dumb idea. For us to have a petition would also be a dumb idea. So we did it. But if I may say so, we did it with flair. We got to work, and within a month or so, they had 100 scientists doubting Darwin. We got 200 scientists, right? 200 scientists signing a statement about evolution is important, it should be taught in school, natural selection's a big deal, and so on. Fine. 200 scientists, but all of our scientists were named Steve. Which was satisfying. And of course, you know, the point was made, right, that the idea that 100 scientists doubting Darwin is significant is absurd when you can get twice that many using, and Stephanie, okay, Steve's and Stephanie's, okay, it wasn't cheating. But 1% of American names are Steve or Stephanie, okay, and do the math, as we were exhorted to in the previous talk. So we've had a lot of fun with projects. And of course, the Steves keep coming in. You know, it's not like we've stopped this project. So if you're a PhD Steve, check us out. We'll get you on the list. A science PhD Steve, I'm sorry. I love historians. I'm married to one. No historians need apply. These have to be natural science PhDs. Okay. No physicians, I'm sorry. You know. We have higher standards than they have. So a couple years ago, the number of Steve started edging up, right? And we began to realize that we were soon going to have the 1,000th Steve. And we needed to do something special for this, obviously, right? The kilo Steve, this is clearly a big deal. So I'll confess to you, because you are all my close friends, and no one will ever hear any more about this when you leave this room, I'm sure. But we managed to arrange so that the Kilo Steve was the distinguished botanist from the Tulane University Botanical Center, Steve Darwin. See what I mean about flair? You know. So now we're, I don't know, we've got 1,200, they keep trickling in, and you know, you're welcome, you can come too, if you're a PhD in natural science, Steve. So we're up to 1,200 Steves, they're stuck at about 800, and they cheat, they use non-scientists as well. What can I say? All right, the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, which is run by a man named Arthur Robinson and his son, It's not a very big operation, actually. It has an impressive sounding 30,000 scientists on an equivalent position doubting global warming. Signatories must have a bachelor's degree or higher. However, they're drawn from a fairly random variety of scientists, including medicine, engineering, veterinary medicine, agriculture, computer science, as well as a couple of climate scientists, actually. The largest category, about a third, about 10,000, was general science, people with bachelor's degrees. And there also were questions about the validity of some of the signatures, since, you know, probably Brad Pitt actually hadn't signed. But in any regard, even if they had 30,000 real, genuine, card-carrying PhD scientists, which would be pretty unusual, they have, you know, bachelor's degrees and everything. The number of people receiving degrees, bachelor's and up, in science since the 1970s, which would include old farts like me and people who would be signing this petition, is about 0.3%. So we're not talking, even 30,000 sounds like a lot of scientists, but it really isn't. Of course, the thing to remember about these claims of substantial numbers of scientists doubting either evolution or global warming is that the number of scientists on the other side of the standard scientific view is minuscule compared to the number accepting either evolution or global warming. Lawyers have a somewhat cynical statement about expert witnesses. For every PhD, there is an equal and opposite PhD. But many people seem to feel the same way. If there are scientists denying evolution, then the jury must be out. Yet for every PhD, there is not an equal and opposite PhD. The percentage of scientists denying evolution is just tiny, especially among evolutionary biologists who can speak most authoritatively. Similarly, the public thinks that if there are scientists denying global warming, that the jury is still out. Yet for every PhD who denies global warming, there is not an equal and opposite PhD. The percentage of scientists denying global warming is a very tiny percentage of scientists as a whole, and an especially tiny percentage of the scientists who actually work in climate sciences and who can speak most authoritatively. Now, there are many other ways that rejectors of science challenge the validity of science, and it's always wonderful to talk about the creationists. A classic creationist technique is cherry-picking the data. You find an apparent anomaly and thereby challenge evolution. Most of the young Earth creationist arguments are of this sort. Here is a lava flow in Hawaii that was dated to be 3 billion years old, and yet the volcano was known to have erupted in 1801. Clearly, you cannot trust radiometric dating. Clearly, the planet is not old. Clearly, evolution didn't take place. All based on this one article. It's phenomenal the way they build a theory. Now, this particular, and of course, I love creationist comic books. They are the only comic books that have citations to the scientific literature. It's just so wonderful. What's not to like about that? Right? It makes we science geeks really happy. But anyway, this really is a real article, Funkhausen and Ott, Journal of Geophysical Research, etc. In this article is talking about how this particular lava flow is anomalous because it includes rocks, inclusions, some of them small, some of them larger, foreign to the lava. They're called xenoliths. They're made of olivine. And they come from very, very deep within the mantle. And when they're included in the lava, if you date the olivine, you're going to get a wrong date. Okay, so this was an article about how to properly use radiometric dating. It wasn't an article to show you how radiometric dating should be tossed into a hat, because it's worthless. But this wonderful anomaly mongering is just so rampant in the creationist literature. If you want to know more about this, you can check talkorigins.org, pandasthumb.org, and our own website, of course, ncsc.com. Well, what about climate science? What about cherry-picking of data there? Well, there are some very interesting ones from our friends at the beloved Heartland Institute. National Snow and Ice Data Center records show conclusively that in April 2009, Arctic sea ice extent had indeed returned to and surpassed 1989 levels. Now, Arctic sea ice melting is a really important matter that climate scientists have expressed a great deal of alarm over as an indicator of oceanic heating. And, of course, oceanic heating is very important because changes in ocean ecosystems, changes in fisheries, coral reefs, the various circulating system of the planet, which has a great deal to do with the climate and on the land, obviously. And this quotation suggests that Arctic sea ice is not melting, but just fluctuating. Well, let's take a look here. Now, here is this is Arctic sea ice area. These are the data that Mr. Bast from the Heartland Institute is talking about. And down there is January, February, March, April, it's 12 months. You know, because obviously the amount of ice is going to vary from month to month. You wouldn't want to compare ice in September when it's at its lowest to ice in January when it's at its highest. You want to compare it month by month. That's very sensible. But you know, the blue line is 1989. The red line is 2009. Sure looks like there's less ice overall in 09 compared to 89, wouldn't you say? Well, what is this thing? With April 2009, Arctic sea ice extent had returned to and surpassed 89 levels. What's going on here? Oh, wait. There's 1 month when the lines cross. This is why we call it cherry picking. Okay? When you look at the data, it is very clear over time. From 1979 to 2012, the amount of Arctic ice has receded regardless of what happens in any given month. These data, which, again, I was multitasking in the back of the room, and I just found these, the new data from the end of February 2013, and it's less ice. I mean, the data are very, very clear. If you want to know more about the denier arguments and how to counter them, there's a comparable source to Panda's Thumb and talkorigins.org. This is skepticalscience.com. It's a wonderful site. You can get an app for it. I have it on my Android. And it has the top 100 denier arguments. Look at that. People are taking pictures of it. I love it. Jotting things down. Good for you. Skepticalscience.com, a really, really good site. And it has the once over lightly treatment as well as the deeper treatment with all of the charts and the 8x10 glossies and so forth. Really good site. All right, I want to talk a little bit about the ideology pillar because it's a significant motivation whether you're talking about anti-evolution or anti-global warming. Now, understanding the ideology pillar means understanding dichotomous thinking, which is rampant in both the evolution and the climate change issues. The dichotomous thinking when it comes to evolution is you have to choose between faith and science. When you think about it, what's really going on is not a discussion so much about science as about the consequences of evolution. If evolution is true, a conservative Christian believes that you lose salvation, you have no motivation to be good, and that society will suffer. Some of us would contest this, obviously. But it's a false dichotomy in more ways than one. There are many intermediate positions between creation and evolution that accept the science. Obviously, the further you are up on that creationism part of the continuum, the less evolution you accept. But people like Ken Miller and other theistic evolutionists accept as much evolution as I do. Excuse me. It's a continuum, not a dichotomy of Christian religious positions. And Catholics and mainstream Protestants theology of theistic evolution accepts evolution as the means by which God brought about the universe and its inhabitants. And there's a big theological literature about the significance of evolution for theological issues such as the existence of God, the nature of salvation, morality, and so forth. More progressive Christians have dealt with this. It's the conservative Christians that have a problem here. Similarly with climate change, there's a false dichotomy that one cannot be a political conservative unless one rejects global warming. You have to choose. But again, what is really going on is not so much a discussion of the science. Is the science of global warming really good? It's the consequences of the science. If global warming is true, believe many political conservatives, then we are in danger of the establishment of socialism. We'll have to restrict carbon-producing industries and thus restrict free enterprise and capitalism. We'll lose our personal freedoms as big government will be telling us what cars to buy and so on. So it's the consequences, if global warming is true, it is the consequences, if evolution is true, that are really the ideological motivators here. And of course, some of us would contend with this issue as well. Again, this is a policy argument, not a political argument. The endpoints are interventionism versus leaving everything where it is, laissez-faire. And there are many policy positions along this continuum that one may choose to debate. Cap and trade versus carbon tax. The policy issues are issues that NCSC doesn't get into. We're not a policy institute. What we stand for is trying to get people to accept good science and let it be taught in the schools. Now, let's talk about the cultural pillar briefly. Arguably, it is the most effective pillar that creationists and global warming proponents have. Steve Meyer from the Discovery Institute wrote that good pedagogy commends the approach of teaching both. Teaching the controversy about Darwinism as it explains, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble reading, as it exists in the scientific community will engage student interest. It will motivate students to learn more about the biological evidences as they see why it matters to a big question. Similarly, Mr. Bast says the goal should be to get politics out of the classroom, not protect it by banning debate and censoring objective sources of research. He's a little more polemic about his views. Note that the implication of teaching only what we would consider the standard science, in other words, the planet is getting warmer and people have a lot to do with it, the implications of that is that you are censoring, you are banning debate, you are infringing upon the academic freedom of teachers and so forth. Very, very negative images. Same sort of images, by the way, occur in the creationist and the anti-evolution literature. Now, I was giving a talk in Minneapolis last summer, as I mentioned, and I still have relatives in Minneapolis, so I visited with some of them, conservative Republicans all. And one of my relatives remarked that because some people think that global warming is a hoax, well, then we should teach that view along with the standard science. And it seems so fair, you know. I mean, this really appeals to people. It's an idea that even some well-educated people might think is a good idea. We're basically a fair people in the United States. That's part of our culture, which is why this argument is so powerful. Not because it's pedagogically good, but because it really resonates with American cultural values. But if we do that, we're deciding what we teach based upon the view's popularity. And you know something? Popular views can sometimes be wrong. And unpopular views can sometimes be correct. For years, history books left out any mention of religion. The Catholics didn't like it when you talked about the Inquisition. The Protestants didn't like it when you talked about the witch trials. So the publishers just said to hell with it and they just took religion completely out of the history books, which was really a bad thing because you need to understand the role of religion in Western European history and American history if you're really going to understand history. But because certain views were unpopular, they were taken out. In English language arts, you have these huge fights between whole language versus phonics, and these have been battlegrounds for years. There are math wars. There are all kinds of things that we fight about in education. I personally don't believe that public sentiment should determine the curriculum. However much that appeals to American traditions of fairness and equal time and giving everybody their say, however much value there may be to local control of education, I'm sorry that curriculum is not one of them. Because there are things that fourth graders need to learn whether they live in Minneapolis or whether they live in Madison or whether they live in Montana. And to have students in Minneapolis, Montana, and Madison all learning something different is not really conducive to having a properly educated population, shall we say. Here's a radical thought. Let's give people who actually know something about the subject matter and how to teach it have the biggest say in deciding curriculum. Is this, as Mr. Bast would say, dogmatic? Does this qualify as banning debate and censoring objective sources of research? No, but it is getting politics out of the classroom. I'm all for that, that's for sure. Of course, debate happens in science. Scientists are arguing about science all the time. It's the lifeblood of the enterprise. Of course, debate takes place in science. Eventually, a consensus on certain issues is reached. And we tinker around, we fight about the details then at that point. But debate is the lifeblood of science. It's something scientists do. It's not something eighth graders do, all right? In the sense that those molecules that we heard about in the last talk, why would a seventh grader be debating the role of that enzyme in translation? That's silly. That's something that scientists have already decided this is how it works. The only reason we want students to debate scientific issues is the ones that get under somebody's skin for a political or some other ideological reason. We need to get the politics out of the classroom, and we need to put the focus on debate where it belongs, and that's in the lap of scientists. Now, scientists laugh at this cartoon. The caption here says, "Most scientists regard the new streamlined peer review process as quite an improvement. Rather than having to go through standard peer review, all you have to do is get to the end of your colleagues beating you up." Well, you know, that's kind of what happens in the standard peer review process, so except they're not carrying sticks and clubs. Peer review is the way that scientists debate the ability of their explanations to really succeed in explaining nature and giving us predictions. It consists of getting beat up by your colleagues until, if you're really lucky, your paper is accepted. My guess is, because this is a campus, there are probably some scientists here. May I reassure you, I will not call on you. This is not like when you were in seventh grade and you raised your hand and then she called on you. I'm not going to call on you. But I would like to know, is there a scientist in the house? Please raise. Keep your hands up, ladies and gentlemen. Don't put your hand. Keep up, up. There. All right. That's what I'd like to see. Now, keep your hand up if you have ever submitted a paper. Hand went down. There you go. Keep your hand up if you have ever submitted a paper for publication. Keep your hand up. Oh, there's still lots and lots. Higher. Come on. They can't see you. Lots of hands are still up. Keep your hand up if every single one of your papers has been accepted. I am not worthy. That's very rare. Okay. Either that or he's a smart aleck, one of the two. No, usually all the hands go down and all the scientists laugh because you don't expect to get all of your papers accepted. That's not the way it works. Nobody promises you a rose garden. This is a very vigorous process that you have to go through. And the sad truth of the matter is that most of the ideas we have are wrong and they don't work out, which is why we don't get all of our papers published. Here's the process. I have a wonderful idea in science. All right, so what I do is I do some research and I submit my research to my colleagues and they give me feedback and I see what I did wrong the first time, so I do some more research and send it back again, and it's this iterative process back and forth and back and forth, and if it's a good idea, and they aren't guaranteed, most of mine haven't been, if this is a really good scientific idea that successfully explains nature, allows us to a greater understanding, maybe some predictability, all that's very good, it will go into the scientific consensus. Huzzah! I've done really well. If it's in the scientific consensus, eventually it'll trickle down into textbooks and into the classroom. Punctuated equilibrium is a very good example. Lots of arguing, you know, it's in the textbooks, it's not such a big deal. Now, Isn't that a whole lot of work? Who'd really want to do all that if you didn't have to? Wouldn't it just be a whole lot easier to just go directly to the textbook? Can't I go to the science czar and say, "Science czar, I've got a really great idea. Bless me. Put me right into the textbooks in the classroom." Well, you know, there is no science czar. But there are school boards. And there are legislatures. And school boards and legislatures are basically trying to bypass that whole procedure by saying, yes, let's teach intelligent design, or let's teach the evidence against evolution in the classroom. Let's just bypass all of that fussy scientific procedure stuff and peer review. If the creationists, the anti-evolutionists, and the global warming deniers want to have their views taught in the classroom, they have to go through the hard work. They can't just jump to the classroom and the textbook based upon their political ability to manipulate decision makers like school board members and legislators. They call this fairness. This is the most unfair thing on the planet to a scientist. And this is why scientists get so annoyed at creationists and at global warming deniers. We are NCSE. You'll find us at ncse.com. If you go here to this button where it says News Alerts, my colleague Glenn Branch has a wonderful Friday electronic newsletter, just a few bullets every week of really depressing things that is going on in creation and evolution and global warming controversies. If you go to this button, you can be taken to the news page, and you can sort for state or you can sort by year. Those of you who are students who are looking for term paper topics, lots of good information here as well. And as I mentioned, we have recently added global warming. Where's that little button that's supposed to come up for global warming? Where did you go here? There it is. Check our climate section as well. And that will take you to this page, and we have a lot of resources there on various topics. We are gradually adding more and more. We are a membership organization, so obviously we'd appreciate your consideration of joining us. We are, as are all good nonprofits, on YouTube and on Facebook. Steve Gould is holding the world's best biological bumper sticker. Honk if you understand punctuated equilibrium. And I'm also on Facebook, but if you do want to be my friend, please friend me here. Please like Eugenie.Scott. There's a number of Eugenie Scott Facebook pages out there, and it's very flattering, and I appreciate it very much. But this is the actual one that I update on, so if you're interested, go there. And thank you very much for inviting me to be part of your program tonight. And I wish you great luck for the rest of the conference.